We know that the insurrection on January 6th was a violent attack that involved vicious assault on law enforcement.
We cannot leave the violence of January 6th and its causes uninvestigated.
We know there is evidence in a coordinated, planned attack.
The American people deserve the full and open testimony of every person with knowledge of the planning and preparation for January 6th.
A peaceful transfer of power didn't happen this year.
We must also know what happened every minute of that day in the White House. Every phone call, every conversation, every meeting leading up to, during, and after the attack.
One rioter said that they weren't there to commit violence, but that, I'm quoting, "We are just there to overthrow the government."
If those responsible are not held accountable, and if Congress does not act responsibly, this will remain a cancer on our constitutional republic.
My fellow officers and I would punch, kick, shove, spray with chemical irritants. I too was being crushed by the rioters. I could feel myself losing oxygen and recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to die, defending this entrance.
As I was swarmed by a violent mob, they ripped off my badge. They grabbed and stripped me of my radio. They seized ammunition that was secured to my body. They began to beat me with their fists and with what felt like hard metal objects. I was electrocuted again and again and again with a taser. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
A man in a QAnon hoodie exclaims, "This is the time to choose which side of history to be on. Do you think your little pea shooter guns are going to stop this crowd? No, we're going in that building." The man in front of me grabbed my baton that I still held in my hands, and in my current state, I was unable to retain my weapon. He bashed me in the head and face with it, rupturing my lip and adding additional injury to my skull.
I witnessed the rioters using all kinds of weapons against officers, including flagpoles, metal bike racks that they had torn apart, and various kinds of projectiles. I sat down on a bench in the rotunda with a friend of mine, who was also a Black Capitol Police officer, and told him about the racial slurs I endured. I became very emotional and began yelling, "How the blank could something like this happen? Is this America?" I began sobbing.
I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Today is the start of a challenging time for our nation as the House Select Committee, tasked with investigating the events at the Capitol on January 6th, begins its work. We've been watching this all day and feeling all sorts of emotion. You've been thinking about it too.
Hi, this is Katie Wild from Portland, Oregon. I've worked in public service most of my life and majored in government. Our constitutional democracy works because of the inherent structure. The January 6th acts of aggression within our Capitol building and against the officers sworn to uphold their peace shook me really severely. My inherent fear was that this was the beginning of the downfall of our democracy, which I care so much about. These hearings are important, and I would like to see people do their best work in this process.
So we begin today by asking, what do we need to know about January 6th, and how can we get the answers? Before the hearings started earlier today, and before we'd heard the powerful testimony from multiple Capitol Police officers, we spoke to Ryan Goodman, co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, former special counsel to the Department of Defense, and a professor of law at NYU. He also had not yet seen the testimony of D.C. police, but we wanted to get a preview of what we'd see during the hearing and why it's so important. Welcome back to the show, Ryan.
Thanks for having me back.
Can you give us a bit of an overview about what the committee's main goals are?
So the committee's main goal is to uncover what happened on January 6th and what led up to it. So as some of the listeners are keen to hear, in fact, the committee will get into questions like, was there an intelligence failure? What kind of intelligence failure? And why did our intelligence agencies fail us? Were they succumbing to political pressure, for example, at the time? And that's one important piece of it. They'll also look into the law enforcement failure. Why were these individuals treated so well in a certain respect relative to the ways in which law enforcement handled some of the summer Black Lives Matters protests, which were largely peaceful. So the idea that there were no arrests, for example, at the scene of the crime on January 6th is an important law enforcement question. And the committee is also going to investigate some deeper questions about what mobilized these individuals to take the actions that they did. For example, social media. How did that figure into either the ways in which some of the individuals organized themselves and some of the individuals became radicalized based on disinformation that they were being fed? So specifically in the text of the committee's mandate is including social media as one of those elements.
So you've just talked for a moment there about the committee's mandate and the text of it. Who is on the committee and from whence came this mandate?
So the committee is something like Plan B. So Plan A was to create an independent commission, very much like the 9/11 commission, that would be created by legislation in Congress, both chambers of Congress, signed by the president, and then it was to have 10 members who would be selected from the public at large, former members of Congress or statesmen, and was going to be evenly split, that the Republican members of the Congress would be able to select 5 of them, and then the Democratic members of Congress would be able to select 5 of them. So that didn't happen. So now we're at Plan B. Plan B is the Select Committee, which is a specially created committee by legislation, by special legislation, which was passed at the end of June. And it was designed in a way that there would be 13 members and 7 would be Democrats and 6 would be Republicans. That's partly because Nancy Pelosi was going to use one of her slots for a Republican who ended up being Liz Cheney. So it's going to be a pretty evenly split 7-6. There are other select committees that have been formed like that in the past. But what we're left with is that we have 7 Democrats and we have 2 Republicans. So we have a bipartisan committee, but it's obviously getting off in somewhat of a rocky start. But at the same time, we'll see what happens over the coming weeks and months in the way in which they perform their duties.
In a piece that you authored for Just Security, you laid out some topics, witnesses, documents that are sort of your suggestions around what the committee should seek to obtain. Can you walk us through perhaps what some of the key documents and who some of the key witnesses are that you feel are absolutely necessary in order for us to get the information that we need as a nation?
So I would put these into different buckets. One bucket really is this intelligence failure. So we need to hear from the heads of the intelligence agencies and perhaps subordinate officials as well. So that would mean we need to hear from the director of the FBI, Christopher Wray. We need to hear from the former head of the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, Chad Wolf. And some huge questions there are, was this an intelligence failure in terms of the collection of the information? Was it an intelligence failure in terms of the analysis that they weren't able to analyze the information that they had? Or was it an intelligence failure of dissemination that they weren't able to provide the information to the necessary actors? And we can get into what each of those might uncover. But here's one example of documents that I'm sure there are records of inside the FBI. The FBI was warned by the social media company Parler multiple times that they had information that suggested, based on what people were posting on their site, that there was a threat to the Capitol on January 6th. They were warned multiple times by Parler. And Christopher Wray testified that that is correct, but he wasn't told about it. So, like, I'd want to know what happened to that information when it came into the FBI. Who received it? Why was it not elevated to the director? Why does Christopher Wray not acknowledge that that is a massive intelligence failure that we as a country need to grapple with? Similarly, the NYPD sent the FBI a packet of material that was about social media indications of a threat of violence on January 6th. What happened to it inside the FBI? So those are some of the questions. There was apparently a rare national call on January 4th of fusion centers across the country in which they were discussing, the heads of the fusion centers, alarming information that they were receiving about January 6th. Documents. What documents were presented before that meeting? Is there a summary of that meeting? What action did DHS take after they were provided this information by the heads of the fusion centers? You know, those are the kinds of intelligence failure questions that can be answered, and there'll be documentation. So I think we might get some real answers A second bucket of questions is the law enforcement failure, the military, the National Guard, you know, the big question that a lot of Americans have, why were they so delayed in getting the National Guard to the Capitol? And we, you know, the blockbuster book that just came out last week by the two Washington Post journalists, Carol Lenig and Philip Rucker, there seems to be a lot of information that the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be able to provide to Congress and the American people about his concerns at the time that the President of the United States would indeed try to stage something of a military coup, a use of the military or imposition of martial law. My goodness, will he be a star witness and could be a star witness? He seems to have a lot to say. We also know from the Senate report that the acting Secretary of Defense of the military called a cabinet-level meeting a couple days before January 6th, in which he and the Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Milley both raised the concern about the threat to the Capitol, even raised the question, could they revoke the permits for people to gather at the Capitol? So it shows you just how specific their threat information must have been. And they were told by, quote unquote, the consensus of law enforcement in the cabinet meeting that they had it under control, don't worry. So that's, you know, very important piece of the puzzle. And then the last piece of the puzzle is, as some people have said, like it's Hamlet. You can't have the play of Hamlet without Hamlet. So it's, you know, it's President Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think there are two sets of questions at least that go to President Trump and his culpability. So one is the question that was litigated in a certain sense with the impeachment trial. Did he incite? And a big question is, what did he know ahead of time about who was coming and the militia groups that were there and what were his intentions? So that's one set. And then the second set is, what did he do once he was in the White House? So there are a number of people that could be subpoenaed to testify about very specific questions. What did you, Ivanka Trump, as an official advisor to the president, say to him to try to get him to make a statement to his supporters to stand down? Because it's widely reported that she went in multiple times to try to convince him to make a statement and got nowhere. So it'd be very important to know, what was the president being told? Was he being told there's a real threat of an attack against the vice president? People's lives are at risk, and he still didn't do anything. Would be an important question. Is that what happened? Because it sounds like that's what happened with news reports, but that's very different from live testimony under oath under penalty of law.
So, Ryan, I appreciate the clarity and the care with which you've walked us through kind of these buckets of things that we need to know. And in part, my appreciation is the evenness of your tone. But by the end of your last response, I did begin to panic a bit. So help me to understand whether or not, as you just said, news reports are something quite different than testimony under oath. Given how you begin with the partisan wrangling to even pull this committee together, is there a realistic possibility that these particular proceedings can give us these core informational answers that we need as a nation?
So I have a lot of hope that the committee will, in fact, give us some real answers on these issues of public policy, the very kinds of questions that the 9/11 Commission chillingly had to face, which is this massive, colossal intelligence failure. 9/11, and I think we had a colossal intelligence failure on January 6th. So for people who care about those issues and want to understand how susceptible, for example, our intelligence and law enforcement agencies are to political pressure, that's a huge question for the country, because we'll have future presidents who might try to bend the law enforcement intelligence agencies. I think they can get answers to that, and I think they can also produce legislative reforms to address the problems. So I do think that that's one part that I'm very hopeful for. I think that the members of the committee are some of the best members of Congress in terms of truth seekers, lawyerly skills, and the like. And it will not be mixed up in a circus that we see with many other committee hearings. And it will not be mixed with a huge amount of disinformation coming from actual members of Congress, which we've actually seen just incredible disinformation being spread by certain members of Congress in these other committee hearings. So I'm actually very hopeful about that. I'm less hopeful about, and has to be realistic about, does it break through the information bubbles that people exist in with respect to how they think about President Trump, how they think about his moral responsibility for January 6th. That one, I think there may be people in the middle. Maybe there are people who have been told many different kinds of lies. And, you know, one of the lies they've been told, for example, is that President Trump, in a scripted remarks on January 8th, said that he immediately dispatched the National Guard to the Capitol. Well, we will probably have testimony from his acting Secretary of Defense, Christopher Miller, and Chairman Milley saying that that's absolutely untrue. So you have people with pretty good standing among many Americans in the middle. Maybe that'll penetrate. Maybe they'll see that live testimony and think, this is a acting Secretary of Defense chosen by Trump testifying under oath. Trump did no such thing. So I think that's less likely that that will shift Americans' thoughts. But, you know, I think we shall see, because there's nothing like a spectacle of a trial. And this is, in some sense, a focal point for people to see what the officials will say under oath.
You've talked here about misinformation and also about the critical aspects of simply what happened, when, who knew what, where were the failures. I want to ask you about motivations. So is there a way to begin to explore the ways that white supremacy may have been fueling what we saw on January 6th?
So I think so. I think, to me, this is a dominant theme that should actually run throughout the hearings. I've been disappointed the degree to which it has not been as prominent in some of the other hearings. And in the joint Senate report that came out, which addressed a partial, you know, a subset of all of these issues, white supremacy does not figure in very prominently in that report. So I think we can get at it, because I think that might very well explain the law enforcement and intelligence failures. So a former counterterrorism official referred to this as the quote-unquote invisible bias, and that his opinion was that the reason that the FBI was so underprepared is because he thought that they were, many of the members of the FBI kind of saw themselves in the Trump supporters and couldn't imagine that the Trump supporters would engage in such violence and, as he said, quote, literally try to and want to kill them. So I think we can get at that. We might get at that with expert witnesses, but we might get at that with an acknowledgement on the part of some of the officials and some of those agencies about that. And then I do think that we will see a presentation, as we are seeing in a certain sense with all of these charges coming out of the Justice Department, how much white supremacy motivated many of the rioters and the militia groups.
Ryan, I can remember distinctly on that day, I said this to the production team yesterday, it is the only time in my life, save for 9/11, when I was watching events unfold and I called my loved ones and asked them to come home. I asked my husband to come home from work. I asked my teenage daughter to come home from work. I went and picked my younger daughter up from school. And it was because I thought, if it's happening at the Capitol, it'll be at the state capitals next. It could be in my neighborhood later today. And honestly, the fact that that didn't happen has allowed me to breathe now for months. But the final question I really have is, at this point, based on what we know right now, before all of the questions are asked, do we have an expectation around the likelihood that this may occur again in the very near future?
So unfortunately, we do, and I think we are on an intelligence footing and a law enforcement footing where there are warnings coming out of the Department of Homeland Security that say there is an ongoing threat, and this is the greatest threat to the country in terms of white supremacist violence. And I think it's a realistic threat. It's in fact, we now have a depoliticized Department of Homeland Security that is able to issue these kinds of warnings that they were not able to do under the Trump administration. And in fact, we have, you know, whistleblowers who have testified before Congress saying that this information was suppressed inside the Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration. This information being the white supremacist violent threat across the country.
Ryan Goodman is the co-editor-in-chief of Just Security, also the former special counsel to the Department of Defense and a professor of law at NYU. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Keith from Dallas, Texas. I have never been so shocked watching television as I was when I saw what was happening to the Capitol on January 6th. It caused me to question the motives of the Republicans, and especially since these people had just been with the president, was doubly scary. So I hope this is pursued as completely as possible by the Justice Department and local police agencies. These people need to be put away.
I was incredulous. I was sickened. I felt my world had come to an end. Having gotten under my desk in 60s grade school for real earthquakes and duck and cover air raid drills, I never, ever could have imagined that I would witness mobs of rabid citizens storming our most sacred edifice, battering doors and windows, attacking police officers, and shouting for the murder of some of our highest elected officials.
This is Jordan from Little Rock, Arkansas. What went through my mind when I saw the Capitol insurrection on January 6th was, if any of those people were black or brown, they would probably be dead right now. And I think the court hearings are absolutely essential for the integrity of the country moving forward.
So I was reading The Handmaid's Tale that day, and that's exactly how that book starts, as the sons of Jacob stage an attack on the Capitol and kill Congress and the president. And that's the only thing that I could think of that day. I just couldn't really get anything done. It was completely surreal and pretty eerie. And I think the current hearings are completely necessary to get to the bottom of what happened, because nobody really seems to be taking it seriously or really care that that happened, but it's completely a big deal. My name's Acacia, and I'm calling from Bend, Oregon.
Hi, it's your friend Ellen from Pittsburgh. I thought that there was going to be a rally on January 6th that the president had encouraged by asking people to come and asking people to walk on up there together. I didn't think any more of it until later in the afternoon when I got home and turned on cable news and heard a report that people carrying Trump flags had barged into the Capitol, pushing aside the Capitol guards to the point where the Capitol guards had to step aside. It wasn't until later that I saw coverage of smoke and violent people pushing through doors and running, and men running up and jumping over seats in the chambers of Congress. I was surprised people weren't being arrested. And as each hour passed, we found out more and more ugly events had occurred. I say investigate and prosecute down to the ground, because layer after layer of information shows that this was not just a rally. This was violence against our government.
Remember this.
Hey, you want to know how to protect something? You wrap it up. You want to protect it? You wrap it up. So, you want to protect it? Wrap it up.
No glove. No love.
Yeah, that 1994 Trojan commercial featuring a suburban mom on a plastic-covered couch while explaining that you just need to
wrap it up
is a classic. And it's a reminder that in the 1990s, battling the HIV epidemic required no-nonsense messaging to clear the fog of homophobic misinformation that characterized so much of the 1980s public discourse about HIV and AIDS. And by the way,
wrap it up
is damn good advice. Condoms are super effective at protecting against a whole host of highly transmissible infections. Which is why I'm thinking maybe those 1994 ad makers need to have a little sit-down conversation with the CDC. COVID-19 cases in the United States are on the rise. According to STAT, July has seen cases increase at the most rapid pace since last winter. Given that vaccination rates are slowing, maybe it's time for the CDC to send a clear public health message. We were kind of thinking maybe something like this.
Mask it up. Want to protect them? Mask it up. Want to protect you? Mask it up.
Here to help us understand what lessons current public health leaders can learn from sexual health educators is Martha Kempner, sexual health expert and author of the weekly newsletter, Sex on Wednesdays. Martha, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you wrote that you have been a condom evangelist for much of your life. Are you now a face mask evangelist?
I think I am. You know, I grew up in a time when HIV was just beginning and we were just learning about it. And we got really clear messages. This is scary. This is deadly. And you have to wear a condom. You have to wear a condom every time you have sex until you are in a committed relationship, and you can define that how you want, but it has to be a relationship where you're not having, you know, bringing in risk from other people, and you both get tested. And I think that my cohort of friends really did that. But when you look at people who are older than me and younger than me, the messages got more muddled. Earlier because there was an HIV and later because it became less of a deadly disease and more of a chronic manageable condition. And I think that condom rates show those muddled messages.
Yeah, Martha, I feel like you must be ex-gen like me. I was in college 90 to 94. And I mean, the messages were clear.
Yeah, it was clear. You use a condom, then it was, I mean, it was almost like, I don't know, maybe it was like the Facebook equivalent of like putting your, we're in a relationship, you went and got tested together even sometimes. And that's when you could stop using condoms.
Now, that said, it's not that it was ever completely easy to have those conversations because look, it for many people and by many positions, right? Sex simply feels better without condoms in the way that life feels better without a mask. So how does public health messaging break through kind of our basic hedonism to do what feels good?
Yeah, you know, it's hard. I think one of the things that we do wrong, though, we have to acknowledge, yes, we get it. You don't want to wear a condom. Yes, we get it. You'd rather not wear a face mask. But I think we also have to acknowledge that we don't have to push that message as hard as we do. We often kind of come at it with such a negative. We're so convinced people don't want to do it that we overcompensate, kind of emphasize the negative. Like, yeah, okay, you don't want to wear it, but here's a great condom.
Now, this is not a perfect one-to-one example. In the clearest ways, how is it that masks are different from condoms?
Well, for one thing, they're public, right? You only have to talk to your partner about whether you're wearing a condom. Only your partner really knows whether you're wearing a condom. Masks have kind of become a public statement of how you, well, really of your politics. I think that's very different because in addition to fighting against people just not wanting to wear them, we're fighting a little bit of an identity politics battle.
It felt to me for a bit before the vaccine that there was kind of an upswing around the like fashion aspect, right? Like that masks were becoming a statement and you saw all of these innovations and, you know, that capitalism was doing what it does and getting in there and kind of making masking interesting. Have we lost that? You know, again, for all the struggles we may have around sort of marketing and consumption, that part felt like it was doing a good public health service.
I totally agree. And I hope we haven't lost it. You know, everyone was making masks from Target to the Gap or whoever. And I think that that's really helpful. I think one of the things that we've done to help condom use is make better condoms. They're thinner, they have better lube on them. And that's helpful. And I think that we should continue to make better masks.
Right. And more comfortable ones. I mean, I can remember in the beginning, it was like, oh, my ears hurt all the time. But then that kind of got worked out in design over time.
Yes, it's very helpful. And I think that that's what we need to keep going on condom innovation. We need to keep going on mask innovation, because the more we can get rid of the negative feelings around it, the better.
Now, when you talk about negative feelings, sometimes kind of Goffman-like here, there's a sense that public shaming can also be valuable for doing things like moving folks towards condom use, even though it's private, or towards mask use, which is more public. Should we use public shaming? And are there effective and, oh, this sounds odd, but almost kind or appropriate ways to use public shaming versus just cruel ones?
You know, my children will tell you I'm the judgiest person in the world, but shaming doesn't work. It's my first instinct, but we know from years of public health research that it doesn't work. I would, you know, I can envision a moment where I see someone in a store not wearing a mask and I try to appeal to their sense of decency and remind them that my 10-year-old still can't get vaccinated. It's not a choice. And she's still vulnerable. So please put your mask on. But I wish that would work. I'm not sure it really will.
It feels like there's one other important sort of connection between COVID and the HIV/AIDS crisis. And that was a sense that we felt differently about it and had different kinds of public health messaging when it felt like everybody was in it together and when it felt like it impacted just one group, like men who have sex with men or, mostly people who were using IV drugs or whatever this sort of single group was, it was easy to ignore it. And I'm wondering if that's what's happening with COVID, this sense that, well, it's not the problem of these people, it's just the problem of those people.
Definitely. I think we want to think our own risk is low. And so what we do is we're like, well, I'm not old or I don't have a compromised immune system. So I'm going to be fine. It's just them. And then when we say it's just them, we give ourselves an excuse to not wear the condom or wear the face mask. And in this case, especially, you know, condoms are a little different because they're just between two people. But this is really a case of a community needing to protect everyone in it. And so othering and putting, you know, underestimating your own risk or putting the risk on other people is not helpful.
Martha Kempner is a sexual health expert and author of the weekly newsletter, Sex on Wednesday. Thanks for joining us, Martha.
Thanks so much.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Welcome back to The Takeaway. And a bit of a warning for our listeners. What you hear next may be upsetting.
2B plus 20P has two terms, the 2B and 20P. Notice they are separated by a plus sign. Also, 3A plus 4 plus 2C has three terms, the 3A, the 4, and the 2C.
Yes, it's the sound of algebra. And for many people, these lessons about constants, variables, and solving for the unknown can trigger sweaty palms and a dry mouth. But algebra just might be the key to racial equity and social justice.
Math and science are sort of front and center with reading, writing.
If people don't have these skills,
then they really can't participate as citizens, just as people who couldn't read and write and didn't have the right to vote couldn't participate as citizens back in the 60s.
You're listening there to the voice of Bob Moses, who passed away this weekend at the age of 86. The legendary civil rights activist faced brutal violence as field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee's Mississippi Project. And Moses was among those who authored an organizing style rooted in the genius of the many rather than the charisma of the few. And though he'll be remembered for his courageous work to extend voting rights, much of Moses' adult life was spent teaching algebra. After winning the MacArthur Award in 1982, Moses established the Algebra Project, a national effort to promote mathematical literacy among economically disadvantaged young people and thereby open the gates to college and to full citizenship. Joining me now to discuss the legacy of Bob Moses and the ways math education is critical to citizenship is Lisa Cook, professor of economics and international relations at Michigan State University. Professor Cook served on President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Professor Cook.
The pleasure is all mine, Melissa.
So maybe begin with just a little memory of Bob Moses himself. You tweeted, quote, Bob Moses embodied the struggle for civil and human rights along many dimensions, inspired by his vision related to math. I volunteered for the Algebra Project in Oakland. Tell me about what Bob Moses meant to you.
There are so many ways that one could contribute to the struggle for human and civil rights. And the example that I saw, and Bob Moses knew my relatives who were deeply involved in the civil rights movement. He helped to organize Freedom Summer. My cousin Floyd McKissick helped to organize the Freedom Rides. That was the example that I saw. Economic development and the protection of voting rights, trying to defend voting rights. Now, that's something that Bob Moses did too, but when I was introduced to him, it was as a person who was studying economics or preparing to study economics, and as a person who'd already tutored math in high school and in college. I met Ben Moynihan, who was my housemate in Dakar, Senegal. Ben is the director of operations now at the Algebra Project, and he was studying drumming, and he was turning his drumming lessons into algebra lessons. And I just found this absolutely fascinating. And when I got back to the U.S., I volunteered for the Algebra Project, having heard the Bob Moses story of civil rights through math education. And one thing that I found, and this is why it was so compelling to me, is when I tutored math in high school in particular, the main thing I was doing was not only teaching students to move to the next grade level and to excel in math, but also to teach the parents to get their kids out of the lower level math courses that would never lead to college, that would never lead to algebra, that would never lead to college preparation, and would never lead to accomplishing a college degree, getting a college degree.
I want to dig in right there for a second, because I got to tell you, the first time that I met and had an opportunity to speak with Bob Moses back in 2014, I didn't get it. I was like, what are we talking about here? And he absolutely brought me over, showed me the light around this question of cumulative math knowledge, the way it builds, and how you have to have algebra. Just even when we sometimes know it, we don't know it. Can you explain to us why algebra is the great gateway for college?
Algebra is a disciplined way to solve problems. And that's how Bob Moses was thinking about it. That's the way I was inherently thinking about it, but it was really implicit. And one thing that I noticed was that a number of my students I was tutoring had been tracked into high school math. That was just basic math. That was just addition and subtraction. It was not algebra. It wasn't adding layers to thinking systematically about problem solving. It really is thinking systematically about problem solving. And I saw this live when I volunteered for the Algebra Project. The kids that I volunteered with in Oakland were in the seventh grade, and they were mainly, if not exclusively, African-American. And they were learning together for the first time. They were solving problems together for the first time, and they were going back and forth. They were iterating and understanding how you got to a solution, the steps that were involved, and they appreciated the various complexities of algebra without thinking about it as algebra. We had so many, they're called word problems for seventh graders, are called word problems, but they embraced them and they enjoyed them, and the content was often relevant. I was telling you that my friend Ben Moynihan was using drum beats to convey math problems and algebra. I was always using change that one makes with money or the dates to convey that. But it was absolutely a gateway. And Melissa, let me tell you about the proof in the pudding. This elementary school was adjacent to the projects in East Oakland, and a third of the students lived together in a foster home. The drug dealers were following them home because they knew they were good in math. They knew that these students were in this program and they were trying to recruit them. So the proof is in the pudding. They weren't just young, you know, they could actually do the calculation. So anyway, that was one testimony that I didn't want. I actually had to address it a couple of times, but I told them about life expectancy. That was a teachable moment. Life expectancy is 35. You know, of course, I was making this up. I had no idea. 35, you can have a glitzy car. You're typically living with your parents. But if you have aspirations that are higher than that, if you want to live longer than that, you might want to choose another profession. So anyway, I kind of shut that down for the moment.
There are so many things about that kind of story you just told about those who are selling illegal narcotics on the black market, nonetheless valuing math skills, right, as indicative of how valuable math skills are. But I want to go back just a little before that when you talked about iterated collective work to solve problems. So I'm not an economist, I'm a political scientist, but when I hear that, people doing iterated work together to solve problems, sounds like democracy to me.
Absolutely it does, and it is empowering. It is absolutely empowering. One of the things that was not accepted or promoted in the algebra project syllabus was just being told what to do. So the students had the skills, so they needed to come up with the solution. And the students were initially frustrated because I was not giving them the answer. I was helping them get the answer, but I was not giving them the answer. And sometimes there was more than one answer. But the question was one of process. How did you systematically get to this? So there was shared thinking, collective thinking. The loudest voices were not the ones that dominated. You could see the quiet scholars like Bob Moses arising in this group. So it was absolutely something that was much more equitable and something that the students felt empowered by.
Professor Cook, here we are at the initiation of the January 6th investigation, and everything you just said has really just hit me in the gut again. It is in part the continuing gift of Bob Moses for you to say, we didn't give him the answers. Sometimes there's more than one answer. It is about the process and it's about systematic thinking. Is there a way that maybe we could implement some algebra project for the democracy writ large here?
We need it. Oh, we need it. You know, when I'm teaching methods courses, when I'm teaching macro, there are some basic facts and basic methods of getting to facts and understanding facts that I teach in all of my classes, because it is my belief that statistical knowledge, and I would say, don't get mad at me because I'm not a political scientist, but economic knowledge, and I'm really saying statistical literacy is fundamental to democracy. I used to say when I started teaching that it will be fundamental to democracy, but absolutely it is fundamental to democracy now. And I would further argue that it would have been helpful to have had this kind of statistical literacy during the pandemic. It still would be helpful to fight disinformation, to fight misinformation, so that people can follow a systematic process of discerning the kind of information they've been given or have obtained. So I think it's absolutely critical to a democracy.
Lisa Cook,
I'm just modern problems.
I was going to say, Lisa Cook, I am just a little black girl living and working in the South right now. And so I can't help but to say this, but right now I am in church because that point about some statistical knowledge, again, I just keep thinking about meeting Bob Moses, not quite getting it initially, feeling like he was saying, oh, you know, we should teach kids STEM in a kind of like, because those are where the good jobs are, which I always kind of bristle at a little bit.
Right.
This idea that actually at the core of what we have to do to make decisions together is to be able to adjudicate information, to understand what data are relevant, which one, you know, what data are not relevant, and how we can have these kind of open processes that we all understand. So how, right, given how excited I am about it in this moment, how do we get past the math phobia that so many people have? In part because that kind of excitement, that drumming, that, you know, like connection to the real world often isn't how math and algebra is presented to us.
That is a great question. And I am asked the same question about economics. The way we get people to address math phobia, or the way we address math phobia, is to give them problems that are relevant for their lives, is to make it interesting, to empower them with tools. One of the things that I found really funny, a colleague in engineering was saying that it was difficult to get women to participate, his women engineering students to participate in hackathons. And I was like, so how are they set up? He said, well, typically people just volunteer and we come up with a question, and then people spend all day and all night, 24 hours straight working on that problem, and they come up with a solution. And I said, okay, so where are women in the planning of these hackathons? And he said, yeah, actually one time when I did this, I involved some women at the very beginning, and we saw more women show up than ever, because this was a problem that was relevant for them, and they were bored by these other questions. And what we know from the literature, from the empirical literature, is that biomedical devices are skewed right now towards men because they're the ones who are making them. And women typically invent to solve problems that are for women. And that should not be the case. This is, more than half the population. We should be more empathetic and sympathetic. And that's why we want more, in my view, more women in STEM and more women in patenting. We need to solve a lot of problems, and not just the problems we particularly have. I'd have medical devices for all tall people, for example, if I were left, if I were left to my own devices, everything would be for tall people.
Oh, for all my listeners who do not know and cannot in this moment see Lisa Cook, she is a tall, regal, sort of Maya Angelou-esque woman. So I so appreciate that. Professor Lisa Cook is professor of economics and international relations at Michigan State University and a former volunteer for the Algebra Project with the late Bob Moses. Thank you so much for joining us, Lisa.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you, Melissa.
And that's the show, everybody. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. And we hope you are as excited about the connections between algebra and democracy as Bob Moses taught all of us who had the privilege to meet him. Now, we really do want to hear from all of you math teachers and tutors, you homework warriors and college professors. How do you make data or math or economics fun, interesting, and relevant? What word problems really connect for you or for your students? Or did you have a teacher that turned on the light bulb of excitement of algebra for you? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.